Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Hello. Is anybody there?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm just going to go to the bathroom right now, so hold on.
Oh, you sounded funny. Well, I can't get my computer screen to come up. Are you on your computer?
Yeah, so there I am.
You're a... What the heck? What's going on? I'm restarting my screen to see what the heck is going on. It's like my computer can't get anything on. What the heck? I was just on it. Can you get on your computer?
Yeah, I'm on my computer.
I see nothing, nothing. My screen is absolutely blank. My light.
Is your screen turned on?
Well, there's a red light on. I just walked away to have some lunch. That makes no sense. I mean, I was just working on it just perfectly fine. Isabel was cleaning in here, but I don't think she's been on my desk yet. Well, I feel helpless, but I guess you're... So you're going to have to run it. Is it time? I don't even have my timer on here because the screen won't come on.
So you're coming up as Ransom Hill Press.
Okay. Yeah, I'm on the phone.
That's all right. I'll switch you to...
I can't live without my computer.
Well, there's always the old turn it off, turn it on.
Okay. I can't see the screen to turn it off. I've got to pull the plug out now. Well, I have questions. Oh, wait a minute. Power saving mode. What the heck? I feel really lost. Well, you can introduce yourself, and you can do the whole thing, and then you've got the time on your clock, and I just have the questions.
Well,
it came back on.
Yeah, all it takes is some signal to get to it.
That was weird. Okay. Okay, so we're by ourselves right now, but last time we were too, and then people started getting on. Okay, I'm going to go in. Hello, everyone. This is Polly Myers. It is Thursday, November 5th, and Josh is on the line.
Hello, everyone.
Okay. Remember to star 2 if you have a question, but because people are so shy here, they often don't ask questions, but they send me a lot of questions. So we will just get started with those. Okay, Josh, you have anything to say before we get started?
No, it's been a good week. I'm doing well. Life is good. I enjoy working with people.
Yeah, I've done some things this week. I had another outpatient surgery, and I didn't have any anxiety, and I went in there and teased the doctors and the nurses because the week before I had another one. It's back injections. And last week, I didn't take anesthetic because I don't like to have anesthetic. I over-respond. And my legs just were flopping everywhere. So I swear I felt like I was electrocuted. Yesterday, it was just great. None of that. And I could walk because last week I couldn't walk for 4 hours. So yesterday was just fun, and we were in and out in no time, like an hour. And my sister and I went out and around town and did some things. Okay.
Well, real quick, you're reminding me. I do have a story from this week. Some of you know that I fly paragliders and sailplanes and all that stuff. And the club I'm involved with has got this winch, which is like a V8-powered huge fishing reel where you have 4,000 feet of line between you and the winch, and it pulls you up in the air like a kite. The acceleration is faster than any car on the planet, and I was getting certified to fly with the club. I'm already certified to do this kind of launching, and so I was with the club instructor, And he said, okay, on this launch, we're going to simulate a rope break at 400 feet, which is pretty common. They want to know that you can handle an emergency. And so what the instructor is supposed to do is pull the handle at 400 feet, and then I'm going to do a 360 and land back where we started. And the rope broke, but it broke at about 80 feet. So you've got the glider. So it was a real rope break, and the glider's nose up at about 45 degrees. It looks pretty weird from the ground, so I'm almost, 45 degrees nose up at 80 feet. And I immediately push the nose down like I'm supposed to, and I start going a little to the left because that's the plan. I was supposed to do a left-hand 360 and land right where we started. And just because I was practicing that in my mind, when the rope broke, I kind of autopilot went into this mode and then quickly realized, no, that's not right. We're too low. And he said, that wasn't me. That's a real rope break. It's still your airplane. So I had to land it straight ahead. And so that's about the worst time in that launch when a break can happen. And still, you go through the ritual, and I landed great. And it was a real neat moment. Actually, there's this thing in psychology called flow, where you get into this really beautiful state where everything's really clear, slows down. And I got into that state because it was a real event. And for about 45 minutes afterwards, you're kind of like high. You're sort of buzzing. And that was fun. And then it wears off, and you kind of miss it. So that happened this week, and those are real moments like that.
I hope you survive.
Yeah.
I can't stand this as a mom, but I love the fact that you can respond so quickly. I know you've been trained really well, although I don't think you've ever had a rope break at 80 feet before. Did you?
No, I had one with Nathan at 300.
But 380 feet, 300 and
it's different.
80 feet
it's just,
is quite a bit different.
The solutions are different. It's the same procedure. It's just you kind of do some slightly different things.
You have to find a place.
Yeah.
80 feet, you have to find a place that you're going to go. Did you see the airplane that deployed its parachute this week? The head of, it's a big company, I want to say Walmart, was flying it, and he had that parachute in his plane, and he had to deploy it, and he ended up landing on a freeway, and they caught it all on video. Somebody did from the ground, and it was pretty amazing. He just clipped one truck on the road, so he survived, and apparently there's about 30,000 aircraft that have that emergency parachute. So
it's called a DRS system. It carries the whole plane and you to the ground. You're probably going to hurt the airplane a little bit, but you're not deploying it unless you're in a life or death situation.
Right. He was.
Seems like a great idea to me. A lot of famous people have died in small aircraft, and if they had had that option, that would have been very helpful.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's a good idea. It's expensive, but it's a good system.
Well, I'm afraid people that are on probably aren't so interested in flying. Think about flying. So any of you guys that are on that have any questions, you can put your hand up, star 2, and we will answer them and get off the airplane kick that we're on. But I'm glad, Josh, you survived. It's good to see that the thinking that we have, the capabilities of reacting in a situation, an emergency situation, are so good compared to other people. I'm sure that you are alive because of it, and I don't think if you were a normal person, you would be from what you've done.
I don't know. That's hard to say, but I know that. I tell people this all the time, that we tend to outperform other people when things get complicated, life and death complicated, and that's true. Everyone I talk to, many people have a story they can remember when things got real slow, and they acted very clearly, and their anxieties were just a distant memory when they were actually in a life or death situation. We tend to do better than the average, so,
Okay, I'm ready for the first question. Hello.
Yes.
I am wondering if there's anyone that gets anxious on Facebook. I mean, when you comment something and you play in your mind the answers that could come back to you. I'm getting anxious in these situations. I know I shouldn't, but I just can't control my emotions. My heart starts racing. So this is a new question we haven't had. We've had similar things where people can't get on the phone, can't do things like that. But here she makes a comment, and then she ruminates about that over and over again. What should I have done, shouldn't have done, blah, 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 and her emotions get the best of her. So and her heart starts racing. So.
Yeah. Social media is an interesting one. Their studies are saying that it certainly can lead to depression. We tend to put this artificially best foot forward in social media. And it looks like...
Artificially desperate, did you say?
So we tend to put an artificially positive, our best foot forward.
Oh,
we
our best foot forward. Okay.
Yeah,
you can erase and rewrite and delete and all kinds of things.
Of course. And you know, if you've taken 10 pictures, you pick the one that makes you look a certain way. We tend not to put our true selves out there. And so for those of us who struggle, social media is complicated. It can sort of exacerbate that desire to artificially inflate ourselves, which tends to be anxiety-producing. Now, on the opposite track, there are places on social media and on the Internet where we can actually learn that other people struggle just like we do. And I encourage people to find some of that support. Sometimes you'll learn what everyone else's symptoms are. That might be a bit weird, but you'll learn that whatever yours are, there's thousands of people out there just like you who are out there on the Internet. So social media, it's a little complicated. I'm not a huge fan of it. You know, it's fine to just the basic stay in touch thing. But when people really get into it and stay up late on it and it affects your sleep cycle and you're looking at a bright screen late at night, that can definitely work its way into depression and make your anxiety worse. The second part of that is we all, not all, but most of us do that kind of, when there's a sense of social anxiety, we tend to play out the scene over and over and over again. This is great when I'm getting ready to go into small claims court and I'm imagining every question I could be asked and I have every answer prepared. That might be an okay time to spend like the hours I do preparing exactly what I'm going to say and how I will respond. And the thing I teach people, though, is reality never works out like you think it's going to, be that the last small claims court I went into or just life in general. So I tend to say it's okay to prepare for a little bit. But we tend to go overboard on that generally, and we can practice letting that go. And yeah, social media is weird because the Internet's permanent. We can kind of delete comments, but that stuff sticks out there, and I can absolutely see it being something that you feel self-conscious about. On the plus side.
I was going to say that chances are she has anxiety disorder, and she's probably got a trigger-happy adrenal, which is what Break Free works on. It kind of calms the whole body down. So she's over-responding in general. This, I'm sure she over-responds in many parts of her day.
So in my world, I see thousands of different specific symptoms of anxiety. And if we go chase all of them, we can end up chasing our tail. What's frustrating about anxiety is you might have a concern about a heart attack. That's a pretty common one. And if you spend time doing your own research or working with me and all of a sudden you realize that you are not having a heart attack for sure and your anxiety shows up and it says, oh, maybe this is a heart attack, and you say, no, I know 100% to my core that that's not what it is. I'm not likely to have one. That's not what it feels like, et cetera, et cetera. What anxiety tends to do is just then move to something else. It's like, I always describe it as like water seeking out a low point. If you fill in one hole, it'll just find somewhere else. So generally speaking, I say, okay, we can work on that specific thing, but at the same time, we want to be treating the generalized anxiety. And when we treat that, symptoms just tend to fade on their own. Big deals become not such big deal if that chemistry is not where it is. The chemistry makes our brain kind of have this catastrophic sort of makes it sensitive to that kind of thinking. So, you know, my comment is either amazing or terrible and I'm going to be judged. And we tend to bias towards the second one. We tend to imagine all the criticisms people might have about our speech, our actions, things like that. So, yeah, you know, we can work on the specifics, but yeah, you're right that getting at the generalized anxiety is the only route to really put this stuff away.
Yeah, and then we work on our perfectionism and all that kind
of
stuff.
Yeah, all the details. We can go backwards. We can one at a time knock down our symptoms, knock down our behaviors. It's a more direct route to go straight to generalized anxiety with, you know, what's in the breakthrough program, possibly medication, exercise, kind of work on that and watch those symptoms just kind of fade.
Yeah.
I
And finally, one day, she probably won't care what other people think about her. But
you know, we tend to go in
so
the
much.
We tend to go all the way to the other extreme sometimes. But no, I you know having you know there was a joke I watched a comedy special and it's you know the comment people say is dance like no one's watching and the comedian's like oh dance like one person is watching. Don't go quite overboard. So yeah, I still care what other people think to some degree, much less so than I used to. But yeah, you can hold on to a little of that.
You ready for the next question?
Sure.
Hi. Since the last 4 months, it started with my best friend on life support machine. I had a massive panic attack. Since then, my vision is funny, had butterflies in my body, shaking, jumping, couldn't swallow, that I could deal with. Since then, I have been having horrible thoughts and can't begin to express how awful it is for me in this anxiety. Is this anxiety related?
Oh, well, yeah.
That's
the classic case of an individual event triggering kind of what we're predisposed to do. We tend to be really good in the crisis. You know, we tend to go be that support person or whatever. And we're kind of storing up all that energy, and then when it's over, we kind of, all that water kind of floods through us. All that stored up energy tends to kind of lack us. And then, you know, seeing, you know, a friend in life support, right? I mean, there's a lot in there as far as loss. As far as our own mortality, that's about the heaviest stuff we interact with. And if we struggle to process that, if we don't have good family support systems and maybe even religious support systems or sort of inner spiritual or inner to face those big issues, it's going to be hard. Even if we do, it's still going to be hard. And for some of us, some people go get angry, some people go get drunk, some people get depressed and tired, you know, and for those of us who are predisposed to this, we have a bunch of anxiety. And you know, I can hear in her question that her anxiety is manifesting in some of her medical fears. So it's a lot of physical symptoms, which is really common. It loves to take our worst fears and make us feel like we're living through them. Even if the symptom isn't quite right, as long as we believe in the symptom, we believe that that's what you know, could be a serious thing, that keeps the anxiety going. So yeah, this is totally fixable, but yes, it's anxiety to answer the direct question. And this is pretty common.
Well, when I read it, it makes me think, I don't know that this person had anxiety before. It doesn't sound like it to me. It sounds like he or she was going along and then this best friend was put on life support. Doesn't say if the friend died or not. But usually for those of us who are predisposed genetically to anxiety, there's a tipping point where we go over. And it just takes a certain amount of stress. He or she wasn't eating properly. You know, the whole routine was different, and the body under stress uses up nutrients and then forces them out when there's a life or death situation, forces out the calming nutrients so you really can't get calm. So I'm guessing this was this person's tipping point. May have had some anxiety before, but just, we see this, I mean, you tipped it 4 or 5, I was 7, my father was in his teens, lots of people in their 20s. When the stress just gets to be enough, then, and the depletion gets high enough, then over they go. And this was a very traumatic event and pushed this person over. This person, if it's very short time ago, could probably get back relatively quickly if their nutrient depletion was filled right away and their body chemistry was balanced out, they probably would come out of that pretty quickly and probably wouldn't have a lot of leftover stuff like those of us who've been having anxiety for 20 years, 40 years, 10 years, whatever. Anything else?
Oh, no, you're bringing up tipping point and when we look at how things kind of cumulatively weigh on us and all of a sudden we reach this tipping point, the great news is it works the same way back the other direction. We can feel anxious, but a little better, a little better, a little better with each little tool we're adding and trick we're using, and then all of a sudden we reach a tipping point and things go quickly kind of on their own. So the system works backwards as well, and I end up teaching that a lot, that we're not shooting for zero anxiety. We just get to where we're nutritionally on track, you know, our diet's taken care of. Whatever the toolkit I make for each person, we're just trying to get you back to that tipping point, and then all of a sudden you'll find that growth happens sort of on its own, back towards calmness once we pass the on the way down. And you're right that, you know, no time like the present to get on something like this. If this is really the first time she's hitting strong anxiety, you get on, the sooner the better.
Absolutely.
So,
you don't make all those imprints in your brain and just,
yep,
you know, it's chill to have one specific thing and then work through that and life will be great. It's when you do it over and over on different, many different things that it becomes much harder to undo. But very, very possible. Okay, I suffered with health anxiety about 3 years ago and had CBT. It helped me loads, and I learned how to control my negative thoughts. 3 weeks ago, it came back very fiercely, along with panic attacks and me being afraid to go out the house. I've been put on beta blockers, and these have helped so much. I'm fine going out of the house now, and I haven't had a panic attack for a week or so. I seem to get a little lightheaded, though, and have a kind of pressure headache. Headaches are a nightmare to someone who suffers with health anxiety, as we always think the worst. I've been like this for about 3 weeks now. Any idea how long it will take me to feel a bit normal again? Lots of points on that one, if you want to start.
Yeah, I'll start. That's complicated. You know, beta blockers might be the source of your headaches, by the way.
Or the lightheadedness. Because you slow the heart rate down.
Yeah, more likely the lightheadedness. So those both might be a side effect of your medication. I know. So beta blockers, I never got much value out of them. I don't see them used very often in the people that I work with for whatever reason.
Well, I don't think they should be using. I mean, you don't want to lower your heart rate so you can't have a panic attack. By the way, I was in surgery yesterday, and I was explaining to the nurse who was I didn't have an anesthesiologist, but they had a nurse there who was acting like one. And I was hooked up to the machines, and my blood pressure was 187 over 76.
Yeah.
And she starts putting these heart monitor things on me, and I said, don't worry. I said, I have genetic anxiety. I over-respond chemically. I don't feel anxious, but my body is responding because I'm in a situation that I'm strapped down, I'm getting injected. I certainly can't run out of the situation. I don't even have any clothes on. And so I said, don't worry. It'll be fine. It'll go right. As soon as you finish the procedure, I'll be fine. So we talked, and she told me that she knew lots of people with anxiety, and I told her what we did. And so she came to check on me as soon as I was put in the recovery area, and they hooked me on the machines. And within, I would say, she took that first one, that 187, it was probably less than 15 minutes when I was back in the room with the new monitors on. And it dropped to 147, then it dropped to 142. And I told her, I said, see, this is all it is. But do you know that they could have easily put me on blood pressure medication, seeing that?
Right.
And so when somebody has a heart problem, when the heart is going very fast, that's the chemistry of anxiety that is pumping up the heart rate. They give them beta blockers so that they'll quiet the heart down. They'll make the heart drop the number of beats. They'll slow it down. Well, when they get in a situation that they need their heart rate to rise, I don't know what happens, but it's not a good situation. And she's going to be running on this low heart rate all the time. So she is probably one that when she has her heart go up, she feels panicky, and so she relates that to anxiety. So she doesn't have the increased heart rate with this medication. So she doesn't think she has a panic attack, which gives her this false sense of security. So it's it's psychological in what they're doing. I mean, they are actually lowering the heart rate, so it can't beat fast, which is what frightens her. But all in all, it's not the way the heart's supposed to be running, and I don't think this is the way. I think we can, when we put people on the nutritional protocol, naturally a lot of that flip-flopping and racing stops. So, and then, you know, the cognitive therapy and things, much, much better than taking your body and turning your heart down. It has a job to do.
Yeah, as she talked about earlier, the cognitive behavioral therapy working, that's similar to what she's doing now. You're sort of treating symptom by symptom.
Mm-hmm.
With the cognitive behavioral therapy, she was going over each specific medical phobia, and yes, cognitive therapy can work. Those fears didn't arise without context. And I have played that game, and I've worked with people on individual fears, and I've found that it doesn't work. But you'll get exactly the scenario that you can solve all of those, sort of like the reason they came to you. If I could just get rid of these fears, then I'd be fine. And so, okay, fine, we work on those. Well, if you don't go after the core, which we believe is a nutritional depletion and a genetic-based generalized anxiety, if you don't start acting that way, it'll just show up in another form. You know, you can do a great job.
Well, it's already showing up, the lightheadedness and the pressure headache. So she's going to start having, she's already said that we always think the worst. So now she's going to start moving it to her head and her headache. So it's like playing whack-a-mole. Dr. Myers used to have patients bring in their boxes, all their pills. And some of them would be 12, 15, 20 drugs. So what standard medicine will do for a person like this is that they go on the beta blocker, then the head starts getting light, then they'll do something maybe to raise the blood pressure or something, and then they'll give her some pain medication for a headache, and then the pain medication may cause her stomach to be upset, and then they'll give her a medication for the stomach. And so what Dr. Myers would do oftentimes is have to unwind all those medications that the person went on because they were doing a symptom by symptom, you know, and some of the medications will make their own symptoms, so they just give you another drug for another symptom. So it's just one on top of the other, and then we just see these boxes of pills coming in, and their body just does not like this at all.
Yeah, for those of you who've listened to me before, I'm kind of neutral on anxiety medications. There's certain people I work with that are on them. I take some. I'm fine with medications. We just need to know what they are. They're just a tool. And in this case, throwing a beta blocker at generalized anxiety, yeah, it might stop some of the panic attacks for a while, but no, it's just not a good long-term strategy, and I'd advise anyone the same way. So, we need to go at the root of the problem and treat the generalized anxiety. The good news is that work that she's already done in cognitive behavioral therapy will come in quite handy.
Mm-hmm.
Once we start treating the generalized anxiety and we remind her of all the skills she's already learned, she can put all that to work and undo what she's creating right now, these connections between different feelings and the fears. And she might still remember some of that stuff and be able to minimize this experience. But, again, we can only kind of dance around at the edges for so long. At some point, we have to really realize what it is, what we're working with, and go to the core of treating the genetic-based chemical sensitivity to generalized anxiety chemistry. And unless we do that, you know, this is what will happen. You'll keep kind of going, and different symptoms will arise, and you may or may not put them down, and new stuff will keep coming. So, and I get a lot of people who've gone through four or five bouts of this. They're finally calling in their late 30s, 40s. Or 50s, and they're just tired of this roller coaster because they've tried each thing. Maybe they tried drugs one time, the therapy another time, they tried meditation one time, and they just haven't, they keep looking for this one thing that will solve it all, and it's not really quite how it works.
Yeah, basically, I think the difference is that we treat the root cause, and I don't know anybody else in the world that treats the root cause. Everybody's got their specialty, and they all do great things. I mean, I would not want to be without my little medication in a crisis, and certainly the cognitive therapy. My gosh, I've had a ton of that, and you love your meditation, but nobody really gets to this root genetic cause like we do. I think it'll be happening more and more, but for right now it's not. They're just treating symptoms and the CBT, they're giving good tools for living, period. Are you ready for the next one?
I am.
Okay, haven't had anything about like this for a long time, but hey, I was wondering if anyone else is scared to drink alcohol because of their anxiety-related palpitations. I drink socially, usually, but ever since my anxiety got really bad, I find myself getting palpitations after a few drinks sometimes. I just want to go out and have fun, but I'm always so terrified something is wrong with my heart.
Well, the palpitations shouldn't be coming from the alcohol. The palpitations should be coming from the anxiety chemistry.
Right, right.
And once you've made an association, you know, there it is. It can happen at any time. I mean, alcohol by itself, when you're drunk, should minimize anxiety symptoms. What tends to happen is after the drinking, we see a phase of oversensitivity to anxiety the next day or the following day. And some people never make that connection. And then we can see some depression creep in also because of alcohol. But once you've made that connection, anxiety is really good at running over whatever chemistry you've put in its way. And in this case, it'll run right over the alcohol. Is there a small chance that there's an actual physical problem in there? Yeah. You know, I'd love to see this person at least get a basic workup. An EKG will it's really simple, and will tell you if there's any functioning errors with the heart. But no, this just sounds like standard anxiety. I would love if alcohol always ran over all my symptoms and I could at least have the fun, even if I pay the next day with anxiety and then the following day with some depression or whatever. But I can't. Just the feeling of being slightly out of control and slightly altered, I can absolutely be anxious while drinking. So I've generally just kind of moved away from alcohol, and I advocate everybody I work with to have very little to no alcohol consumption in their life. It just tends to help everyone. Here comes the holidays, and I'll probably have 4 or 5 drinks over the next 2 or 3 months getting through this whole season total. And will there be some symptoms from that? Yeah, a little bit, but, you know, well, I might not, but, you know, gosh, somebody brings some special wine or some special beer at, you know, Thanksgiving and all those different family functions I'll be attending, I probably will partake a little, and I will pay a little, and I have decided that's okay. But, anxiety can absolutely run right through alcohol or any drug, really, and still show up and still cause this. So, but, you know.
Well, one of the things directly related to alcohol is, but it wouldn't be this quickly. So I think you're right. She's just, he or she is not dealing with the anxiety. I don't know why it would come directly related to alcohol, except that alcohol will deplete your system, particularly of the B vitamins. There are B vitamins in alcohol, but they're very unbalanced. So when you drink alcohol, it needs to find the missing ones that it didn't get, because when they do make the alcohol, like it takes grain and they make alcohol, the grain starts out with 24 B vitamins. By the time it gets to alcohol, it doesn't have all those B vitamins. So this imbalance can create problems in your body because it goes looking for the rest of them somewhere. And so it could show up. But with the heart, it's very interesting because the heart is one of the fastest repairing organs in the body. It's amazing. The heart is a great big muscle. And one of the things that we do when we have anxiety is that chemistry forces out the nutrients that are responsible for contracting and relaxing muscles. And so the heart, being just a great big muscle, reacts to the depletion of those nutrients, and it can't pump properly. So you'll get fast heart, you'll get the fast, intense heart is usually when the chemistry is right there and it's pumping it up for you to run. But in the long run, you get these flutters, stop, And then there's compensatory beats. The ventricles will give this really hard beat when the, oh my gosh, I forgot the name of the top, the two chambers on the top of the heart. Anyway, it'll compensate atriums. They don't function as well, and so the bottom one will squeeze really tight, and so you'll get this really hard beat at trying to force the blood that didn't get forced out before. And so you'll get these, it just feels irregular, and sometimes it can make you dizzy because it'll stop, and it will, then it'll catch up, and then it'll flutter, and then it'll give this strong beat. Everybody's heart's probably a little bit different, but basically that's how it acts. And that's just because it needs the food. It needs the minerals in particular to keep that heart beating. Just like all the other muscles that need to contract and relax properly. You'll see people get foot cramps, leg cramps, all kinds of things when they're missing these nutrients. But the heart, it scares you more, I think, than any other, like getting a leg cramp doesn't scare you. But when your heart goes flop, 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 that scares you. But that's all it is a big muscle that just needs you to put the nutrients back in it so that it can do its job.
Yeah. When I get people that have this laundry list of physical symptoms that are all related to nutritional depletion, I'm like, oh, this is going to be great. You know, not only are we going to work on your anxiety, but you're going to sleep better, your heart's going to function better, your intestines are going to function better. And they're asking, is this all anxiety? And it's like, kind of. It's both anxiety and the effects of chronic anxiety depleting your body. And yeah, it's just fun to watch people they improve so quickly. A week is common to see all kinds of physical changes occurring in people that are really depleted. So I actually kind of like it when I hear people that are really depleted. I know how well the program is going to work for them. It's kind of fun.
Yeah. Over the long term, Dr. Myers always used to say, please at least stay 6 to 8 months on the program because your cells get fed, they make new cells, and every cell in your body turns over at a different rate. Like in your mouth, if you'll notice when you burn your mouth, the next day you don't feel it anymore. Chances are, I mean, unless it's
really bad. Yeah, unless it's really bad.
Yeah. So it turns over the cells in 24 hours. But then if we go to the far extreme, nerve cells don't turn over for about 36 months. So Dr. Myers kind of says, gives them a goal to stick with it so that we can kind of see how much better we can get. So 6 to 8 months is kind of a great time to start repairing those cells and then having them turn over so that there's new cells available. And that's when we see some really significant stuff. Although you can see some really significant stuff in the first week for many people. Yeah.
Yep.
It just depends on where it's going and how fast it can fill up the holes. Okay, here's another question. So there's this saying that once you let toxic people out of your life, that you'll be happier and love yourself. But what do you do if these toxic people are your family?
Huh.
I know, yeah. We haven't had this question. I mean, we've had issues with family, but...
Yeah, that's situational. That's person by person. You know, how toxic? You know, what's your family worth to you? Unfortunately, yeah, we don't always get to choose our family. And so, yeah, I understand, you know, it's funny, it's difficult for me to answer this question, right, talking with my family on the line, right? That's just, there are some situations where you can choose to extract yourself. You know, I think I'm in a pretty good place now where I have my own sort of support network of people that I've pulled into my life who aren't toxic, in this case, my wife and my children, my friends. And that allows you some freedom, right, to choose. But we don't all have that. Certainly when we're younger, we're a little more dependent on our family. And, yeah, it's situation by situation. You just there's a lot you can do to kind of defend yourself. Toxic boundaries are a big issue to discuss in this question about what you allow your family to comment on, not comment on, how you allow them to affect your life. You can put some boundaries up even if you still have to be around them. Ask them to respect certain boundaries. Learning to say no comes up a lot. So, yeah, it's a little too complicated to answer generically, but, yeah, situation by situation. And I have seen people who pretty much don't involve themselves with their family anymore. That's never ideal, but there are some families that are that toxic, where it's probably a net loss to continue to interact with even a small portion of them, unfortunately. So, yeah.
I tell people, they feel so bad. I get emails and I've talked to people and they feel so bad. I mean, some people have been rejected by their families. Some people have terrible families. And I tell them to go out and make a new family, because there's lots of people out there that don't have family that would love you to be their family. And, I mean, you have to be careful. You want to make sure that these people are safe for you to give yourself over. But just because you have a toxic family doesn't mean that that has to be your family. Does that make sense to you?
Absolutely.
I mean, I have spare boys, as you know, that don't have any family, and they're just very happy to be a part of the family, and they're certainly not toxic to me at all.
Yeah. We have to pick and choose situation by situation. It is possible to create the world that you want. That isn't going to happen overnight. But, yeah, you can choose who you bring into your life. Yeah, some people, I like people who kind of know a little bit about anxiety, even if they're not, you know, they tend to understand. I feel a little safer around them. They tend to be more compassionate around anxiety. But I also hang around with people that have never even, I don't think, had an anxious thought in their life. And that's fine. That's okay, too.
They can still be compassionate. I've known people who've never had any kind of anxiety, don't understand it, but they're caring enough to accept you for who you are.
Yeah.
So it doesn't mean that you can't have people that have never had anxiety. Okay. Hi, all. I suffer severe anxiety and panic attacks. I don't leave my house as I'm too scared. I really need to see a dentist, but too scared to leave the house. I also have a phobia about treatment. In the past, I have always been sedated, but the problem is getting from my house to the dentist. I am able for a home visit, but I'm just so scared to have any treatment without sedation. Does anyone feel the same and have any advice? I just know if I went through with it, I would be panicked all the way through and my anxiety would get worse. I'm not coping well as it is. Any help? I would be grateful, full of thanks.
Yeah, so, you know, this one kind of requires us to go right to the psychological core of anxiety. We tend to, when we first experience anxiety, attribute it to something outside, external, part of our surrounding. This makes sense for two reasons. One, usually this system was designed when stuff tried to kill us from the outside. The fight or flight system is supposed to trigger like this when there really is something trying to kill us out there. When it triggers on its own because of our genetic predisposition, nutritional depletion, and stressful situations, and all of a sudden we reach that tipping point we talked about earlier, the first instinct is to reach and find external explanations. Our body is in overdrive. Our mind is in overdrive, trying to find. It's the restaurant. It's the car. It's this person. It's, you know, being in a forest. Whatever. It literally will grab anything to try to explain why this is happening. The reason, psychologically, that it's so preferential in the moment to choose something external is that if you really honestly acknowledge what anxiety is, it's something coming from the inside, which is infinitely more frightening than it's caused by my neighbor, Jim. It's much easier to say, oh, it's Jim, and as long as I stay away from Jim, which I can do, then we kind of trick ourselves into thinking that that's the source of the anxiety. That's not the source of the anxiety, and I would generally ask this person, have you ever had a panic attack in your home? Why is it you feel safe in your home, even if you've had anxiety? Right? You know, I can almost guarantee you this person has had panic attacks in their house, maybe dozens or hundreds, but there's nowhere left to run to. So they stood their ground, and they got through it, and they still probably attributed it to something they got in the mail, or, you know, this pattern just keeps going on and on and on. So by the time most people get to me, they've experienced enough of this, and they're kind of sick of it, and they can't imagine continuing to live this way, and they're hopefully open to the idea that it's coming from you. And that requires us to confront this reality, which is initially frightening. However, there's a beautiful other side to it, which is once you realize that you are the source, you can be calm wherever you are. in France, in the dentist, in the airplane, on the train. It doesn't matter. You're still you. Same chemistry, the same cellular design. You're you in all these different situations. Now, that's a whole lot of work to get to, for starting from where this person is starting from. So, of course, can we treat this moment and get this person to a dentist and home? Yeah, it's called Xanax, pretty much. But to really get the, you know, is that what's really the problem in their life? No. You know, is it just that they can't get a dentist? You'll notice, it's like, if I could just get to a dentist, life would be fine. No, it's not. You're a housebound agoraphobic at this point. You are not living the life that you were designed to. This is a self-induced prison sentence that comes from a lot of illogical thinking. I understand every step to that process. I've walked down it myself a lot.
Me too.
So, yeah. So
I was housebound, so I really can relate to this person.
Now, you know, I of course, I'm compassionate and gentle about this, but acting like just getting to the dentist is the solution to living well is short-sighted. And so, unfortunately, we have to confront the bigger picture and sit with that. And that might temporarily induce higher levels of anxiety, because we're losing the illusion that it was that the anxiety was because of avoiding all these things. And the pattern is so common. You know, if you just imagine associating with the car, the bus, the restaurant, you know, eventually everything outside becomes scary. When in fact, had you stuck in the car, in the airplane, and just refused to believe that that was the source, and you stayed there, you would actually have that become your safe place. It could never establish itself as a problem. But we're able to leave the car, we're able to leave our friendships, we're able to leave our neighborhood, and ultimately get stuck in our home. And I get it, but, you know, and I've worked with people a little bit like this that just say, oh, I just need to get to the dentist. What's funny is I've literally worked with someone that it was dentistry, and it was exactly this question, more or less. And you know, I got into the dentist, but that's not a victory. I mean, it's a little victory, but it didn't feel very, it felt shallow. And I don't, this person doesn't call me anymore, so, you know, whenever they're ready to get their life back, great. But
it is bad that they're stuck in the house, and they've just chosen one thing, because apparently they may have a toothache or something, so they need to get to the dentist. I'd like to see this person really work on the anxiety and then start working their way outside. One of the things that I wanted to say about this particular issue is that a lot of people have the phobia of the dentist because they put epinephrine in the it's in with the anesthetic. So epinephrine stimulates, or Josh, is it actually the same chemistry?
It's the same chemical.
Okay. So
it is. Yeah, when we say adrenaline or epinephrine, those are interchangeable. Those are the exact same chemical.
So the dentist puts epinephrine in the anesthetic for two reasons. One, it makes the anesthetic last longer, and two, it makes your gums or your mouth bleed less while they're working on you. So they do that on purpose. If you know that, I've noticed now, I've had to have epinephrine put in for certain procedures. I ask for it not to be put in general, because it makes your heart beat fast. It'll make you have a panic attack. So I have learned to tell them that I have anxiety disorder, maybe take a little Xanax, and ask that I not have epinephrine put into my numbing agent. If I can't get away with that, then it only lasts about 10 minutes. So I know they inject, I get up, I walk around, I go to the bathroom. I know why my heart's racing. I know why I'm feeling this way. And then it just starts slipping away. But before, I would just freak out because I didn't understand what it was. It wasn't me. It wasn't me having a panic attack. It was just the response of the chemistry. And so I don't have any problem going to the dentist anymore. We have a hand up.
Oh, great.
Do you see it, or do you want me to take care of it?
Yeah, I'll do it.
Okay.
Hi, Ms. Crouch.
Hi there.
Hi.
I have.
What's your question?
I had a question that I was going to ask before the subject came up two questions ago, when you were talking about the toxic people in the family and so forth. my husband and I were discussing today and have been for years about my inability to, you know, just do certain things, just do common things that my role as a wife would do. And, you know, I'm like, for better or for worse, you know, we're in it till the end. And so I'm not like, I'm not going to, I think he's gotten part of the worst part for some of the times. But we were just, I told him, I said, you have a very good question today. And I said, today's the call, I'm going to ask it. So okay. His question was, how is a spouse supposed to survive, like happily, when some of the basic wants and needs and activities and desires are just like not being met or being ignored? And for a long time, I didn't even know why. I mean, I knew that it wasn't something that I could do, but I didn't understand why. And now I know why, but the consequences are still there, and they're still, you know, things that are going on that I don't. Like, and it's hard for, like, a spouse or maybe a family member to understand where we're coming from as people with, you know, anxiety disorders and so forth. But how does a person, you know, get that across, and, you know, how do they understand? How can they survive?
Well, usually when we have anxiety, we look at all the things that we can't do. And we kind of, I'm going to mute you just for a second because you've got some background static.
Okay.
Okay. Actually, it's okay now.
No, it's still there.
Okay.
I know, but you're going to want to ask her questions, so.
No, it's okay. You can stick your hand back up. So you're muted now. But we tend to look at this one element of ourselves, our anxiety, and we tend to really be self-judgmental about, this is this horrible thing, you know. I'm a guy, right? I'm supposed to be a provider, and I'm supposed to be strong, and kind of the symbol of strength and courage in the family. And women have all kinds of expectations to participate in all kinds of family activities. It's hard. But remember that we come with all these good characteristics. The thing that we're there, the reason we're married. This is a whole package. We're much more complicated than just our anxiety. We tend not to focus on that. From the spouse's point of view, this is solvable, and it's frustrating because we don't really, in popular culture, have all the solutions. You know, we think that we've added kind of like the last piece of the puzzle, and that we can return people to normalcy pretty quickly. And that's my goal when I work with people. Hold on. I can't absolutely tell you that every relationship would survive somebody going through, you know, 10, 20 years of anxiety. There's no reason for someone to go through it that long with what we know now. But I kind of struggle. There's a role for that person to play, which is not this weak, passive, just sit back and let the person suffer. That's not what being a good support person looks like. We want to be compassionate around each specific challenge and in the moment be very flexible, open, understanding. But we also want to be really rigid that we see our partner getting better all the time. And I think that would be what I would be looking for if I were a partner of somebody who was really struggling. As long as I saw them working, growing, I can support that, and I can put my needs on hold for a long time and love them for the whole person. Yes, there's some limitations here, but there's this big picture about why this person, you know, is intelligent and compassionate and understanding and sensitive and all these beautiful things that I really appreciate, and look at this as a consequence of all of that and say, okay, we've got to get, you know, iron this out. And as a support person, yeah, I'd want to be really, I would describe it this way. In the moment, really flexible and understanding. In the big picture, very rigid that we're always moving forward towards getting our life back. Mommy has something to say?
Oh, well, as you know, your dad left twice because I was such a pain in the butt. I mean, it was really hard. I was so restricted when I was totally housebound and everything. I'm wondering here, and we probably need to open the line, and maybe, I don't know if she wants to divulge this or not, but what is it that he wants her to do? Because eventually I was able to do the things my husband wanted me to do. I worked on each one of the things, like being social, flying. We ended up in Europe. We went to Hawaii. We went, I mean, numerous things that we did. He ended up having his issues, and I had to take care of him, too. Mm-hmm. So I ended up, you know, feeling trapped and helpless and all the things that he felt with me. It just, the roles switched at times. You know, that's what happens in marriage. But I did work on specific things that meant a lot to him. So if you want to open and ask if she's willing to talk about something maybe that he wants from her, then I think that's exactly what you do for people.
Sandra?
You're open.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, is there anything specific that
well,
you want to talk about?
Gosh, you know, it's kind of the whole picture. It's anywhere from, you know, activities to household things that, you know, just don't go in a flow in personal attention and, you know, personal needs and so forth. So I think probably one of the things that, if I understand anxiety correctly, then maybe I can, you know, take one thing at a time and say, okay, that's what I'm going to focus on. I'm going to, like Polly said, the flying or the whatever.
Yeah, you can't, you've got to break it down. I mean, would he like to get on the telephone? And because it is frustrating to be the partner. It's terrible to be the partner. It breaks your heart to be the partner, but it also is upsetting my husband. I would just send him off to do his things. He would go to parties. He took the motorhome, and he traveled around the United States because I couldn't do it. So we made these compromises in our relationship so that he could feel like he wasn't constantly being deprived. Sorry, that's my other phone. So, you know, I don't know what his complaints are or what his needs are, but, I mean, if he's welcome to get on the line because he's just as important, too. It's, being a support person is really tough. I want him to know that we understand that.
Yeah. Well,
Okay,
I don't want to put you on the spot.
Yeah,
and or him.
Maybe. It feels like maybe next time, but, yeah.
I think I have, you know, gone through the, I feel really bad, I mean, for him, because I really do and don't do things that are quote-unquote normal, and so I was just wondering, you know, how, I guess my point is I really want him to understand the whole concept of what's really going on. And it's hard for somebody not to understand that when they're not.
Has he read the little booklet that we put out, or watched the Fearless Live More video? That would kind of help him understand a lot. And also, I know that you've made a lot of progress. I know that. I can see it. Josh can see it. Is he too close to see how much progress you've made?
I think the layers of things that I've made progress on, and I do agree that I do think, God, have more tools now than I've had before and even recognize what's going on in the first place. But some of the things are, you know, I guess they're deeper issues, and it's kind of like, you take it's kind of like the onion thing, you know, you kind of peel it, but the easier things come off first. And so, you know, that's why I just asked that question, because I'm at the point now where I think maybe I'm capable of dealing with that, like the deeper issues and so forth. So that would be something that...
Well, that is good to hear, because you're ready. If he would make a list for you... he may not even realize what he's unhappy about. He may just be lumping everything all together. I mean, and he may be able to help you with a lot of things. You may have a small goal that you set. When I first started flying, oh my gosh, I had to look at a picture in a magazine to even look at an airplane. And then had to make a telephone call to make a reservation, had to go to the airport and sit in the parking lot, went to the airport and went to the terminal, walked around the terminal, and then finally I made a 20-minute flight, drugged myself up and went on the 20-minute flight. So it wasn't easy, but that's how I did it, little bits at a time.
Yeah.
And then it got to the point where it was, I'll never forget the day that I was flying to Hawaii, and the first couple of flights were still upsetting, and, you know, watching the bathroom, watching the time, watching. And then one day I went, got in, sat down, and went, oh, my gosh, I've got 5.5 hours. I don't have to do anything. They're going to serve me food, and I'm going to watch a movie, and I'm just like, oh, this feels so good. What a change. It was such a shock. It was such a shock to feel that way. So baby steps into whatever, but maybe find something that he really wants to do or wants something from you, and you and Josh can work on that.
Well, and another thing is I get the sense that there's this expectation that when your anxiety clears up, that you're going to be this perfect partner and everything's going to just fall into place in your life. And we're still complicated, messed up people, and we still have all kinds of work to do in other areas. Relationships are just constant work. We grow only to get challenged by new and fun, different challenges that life throws at us, and then we have to grow through those as well.
And then we get old and die, so we have to deal with all those.
Yeah,
so,
no,
this is preparation for old age, I tell you.
Yeah, the skills of resilience that we learn getting through this may help our ability to handle. But what I'm hearing in that question is that there's stuff even outside of anxiety that now, kind of like the excuse is gone, the idea that, you know, now I'm more capable and now my partner's saying, you know, I need to grow in these other areas, and that might be true. And that might be some therapy, that might be some talking and learning and lots of good literature and relationships. And so, yeah, don't assume that just because your anxiety goes away that everything in your life falls into place. In fact, sometimes it actually gets really complicated where our anxiety goes away and our partner's finally able to ask us for other needs that haven't been met and that we put to the side while we've struggled with anxiety, but now it's time to continue growing. So, yeah, sounds...
Yeah, and he may have some things he needs to do. He probably won't
want
to hear that, but the fact is that the scale gets unbalanced and it needs to be rebalanced. So he may not be used to having a wife that's now starting to come out of her anxiety.
I see that a lot. For,
in
family members, yeah, it's odd. When people get better, it actually upsets the balance. And there's some adjustment period, let's say, where we kind of rebalance the scales and get used to working together in a different way.
And the partner has to start looking at their part, too. Well, sure. It is after 1 o'clock.
Yep.
So unless... Sandra wants to say something else. Sandra, if you do the star 2 real quick. Otherwise, we're going to go. Oh, there she is.
Yep.
Okay.
Yes, yes,
sir. Yes, I just wanted to thank you and realizing that it's good to be in the position that at the point where I can now address things and really work on them, you know, the deeper issues, and that's a good thing. So I just have to be positive about that and say, yeah, good. So thank you for that idea and suggestion, and thank you so much.
Just know that we've been there.
Yeah.
We've been there. Okay. We will see everybody, or we will be on the phone with everybody November. It'll be Tuesday, November 17th, because the days were early this week. And then everybody's going to have a happy Thanksgiving here in the United States, and we will talk to each other the first part of December again after a big break there. Okay, I'm going to say goodbye.
Am I going to be in San Diego with you by the 17th? Is that
no, no, you're going to be there
like
a few days after.
Okay.
Looking forward to seeing you. Bye.
Yeah. All right. Bye, everyone.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.